as was mentioned, I've always been anxious to do anything that I could to help the students. I've been very happy to have many personal contacts with them. But I found out years ago that I have no memory for faces. I'm just the opposite of most people. I used to rarely remember faces, fairly well remember names, but I've always remembered facts, and I do now. But what good is the fact, unless you have the name, and what good's the name if you can't recognize the person? So, through 54 years of teaching, I practically always assigned seats to my students. And then I would have a chart in front of me, and I would come in 5 minutes before class. And particularly in the first few years when I taught beginning Hebrew, this enabled me to know each student by name much sooner than almost anybody else. That's one thing I regretted about not continuing teaching beginning Hebrew beyond my first 7 years, was that I no longer had contact with all the students as soon as they came in, like I did in those years. Now, you see, I'm doubly handicapped in that regard now because I don't have much contact with students. And as I say, I'll talk with somebody, and then the next day I may not recognize them all. But if I'm told who it is, I'll remember everything they said when we were together, because I still have an excellent memory for facts. Now, as was said, it is difficult to think in a few minutes of saying much about two men whom I knew very well, and men whom I had not admired very greatly. Dr. Machen was probably one of the most versatile scholars and one of the most exact scholars of this century. And not only that, but he had a marvelous gift for expression, for saying things clearly and succinctly. I went to a college which a few years before I entered it was one of the best Christian colleges in the United States, I believe. In fact, the man who was president of it the year after I left remarked that he, I don't know that he was right, but he said that Occidental College had a larger percentage of its graduates in Christian ministry and mission field than any other college in America. And I immediately thought, well, if you have your way, that won't continue very long. And it has. Because it was, as I say, one of the best Christian colleges in the country a few years before I went there. And when I was there, it was just in process of transition. The dean said to me one day, he said, we tried to have our teachers in the fields of the humanities and all those areas to be sure they are real earnest Christians. He said, we get questions about our scientists. They're unavoidable, he said. But he says, we try to keep these fields absolutely safe. So he was a fine Christian man. But the college was in this process of change. And today, like most of the colleges in the United States, it is quite unchristian. Well, after I finished, I believed exactly what I did when I entered, because I felt always that I'd been able to see enough flaws in what the liberal teachings presented to see that at least there was just as good reason for what I believed as there was for what they were presenting. And very often I would write a test. I'd be asked a question. I would say in the exam, the professor has said. And then I would state exactly what he said. Only with one professor there, I would say the professor has said, and then after I gave him exactly what he said in class, then I'd say, but this is the way it looks to me. And he liked that, because he knew I was thinking, but he thought I would come around to his view at the end. And when I gave the valedictory address, I called it the Siege of Damascus, and I spoke of the attempts to destroy the Christian faith of the college. And the president, who was sitting behind me on the platform, said, good speech, John, good speech. The next year, I took a graduate year, and someone told me that one of the professors told them that in the faculty meetings, the president often said, there'll never be another Ellen McCrae on the Occidental College platform. Well, that gives just a sample of the way that dozens of colleges and seminaries in this country have gone. At the beginning of the century, there were many fine Christian colleges in the country, and hardly one of them today stands for the faith that stood for then. Of course, there have been many new Christian colleges established. But the old established colleges and universities mostly have given up the Christian faith. And Dr. Machen tried to hold back that process. By the time that I went to seminary in 1925, that's nearly 70 years ago, I guess, now. By the time that I went there to study, most of the theological seminaries in the country had been taken over by the liberals. And Dr. Machen was the man who saw this trend, how it was developing, and tried to hold against it. And many people today will talk about him as if he was a fighter and a controversialist, and that's all there was to him. But that just shows their ignorance. Because Dr. Machen was one of the greatest theological scholars of this past century. Dr. Machen's book on the origin of Paul's religion takes up the attacks on Christianity from the viewpoint that Paul got his ideas from one of two sources, from the Hebrews, from Jewish tradition, Jewish ideas, or that he got them from the Hellenists, from the Greeks. And he takes up the evidence as it was being presented then and gives a marvelous answer to it. His book on the virgin birth, of course, is a masterpiece of solid scholarship. After he died, there were eulogies of him, even by many of the ungodly people in the United States who wrote about him, praising his scholarship and his ability to express himself and his character. The people who didn't like his character were not the ungodly, but they were the people that called themselves religious and wanted the schools to gradually turn over and become completely unchristian, as most of our universities are today. Practically all the so-called Christian colleges that were in existence at the beginning of the century. Before I went to seminary the year before, somebody gave me a copy of Dr. Machen's book, Christianity and Liberalism, in which he shows how, as he says, liberalism is not simply a different religion from Christianity. It belongs to an entirely different type of religion. And he goes through it and takes up their attitude toward the Bible, their attitude toward God, their attitude toward Christ, their attitude toward the church. He takes up each point and shows how liberalism, which was infiltrating the churches and taking them over one after another in those days, that it is utterly different from Christianity. And I've been told that at Princeton Seminary today there is a course in which the students look at Dr. Machen's ideas, and they think that is a better way to protect them against being hurt by these ideas later on, I guess. But somebody went in there and saw this book in the bookstore and spoke to the student who was working in the bookstore about the book, and he said, I really don't think they ought to sell that book. Have it here. It's a dangerous book, he said. When you read it, it's so convincing, he said. It almost convinces you that he's right. Well, Dr. Machen had a marvelous gift for thinking and for expressing his thoughts clearly. His radio addresses have been printed in books. God and the Bible is one of them. Christian faith is another. His book on what is faith, I've never read, but my wife was speaking of what a wonderful blessing she had gotten from that book. He was outstanding thus as a scholar. Now today, people who like to attack him and try to make it look as if he was some sort of a an ugly, a person with an ugly temperament who hated those who didn't agree with him. But nothing could be further from the truth. He was a most genial fellow. I never took his beginning course because I had had Greek before I went to seminary. But they said that he lightened up the course. He would go around throwing chalk in the air and catching it. He'd stand up on chairs and he'd do all sorts of clownish things in order to kind of make it light, and yet was driving the Greek into the minds of the students. I never saw that because in his more advanced courses, that side of him, you didn't see. He never married, and he lived in the dormitory. And they used to announce every so often, the word would be passed around, checker club will meet tonight. And that meant that Dr. Machen's room was open to any students who would like to come. Of course, in those days, practically all the students were unmarried. There was no tuition charged in those days, incidentally. Anyone was welcome, and he would have all kinds of fruit and candy and so on around, and then he would play chess and checkers, and they had other games. They would spend a couple of hours that way. Once, when I was first there, before he knew me yet, I played a game of checkers with him, of chess with him, and he didn't know me hardly yet, and he didn't pay a great deal of attention, and I beat him. Well, he immediately said, "We better have another game." And in no time, he had me cornered. He was a very great mind and a very wonderful man. He used to give stunts, and he would tell how Jim Davis won the Battle of Waterloo was one of his recitals he would give. And one was on teaching of pronunciation. He kind of made fun of it, you know. And people, if he was at any place in the evening, they always would call for a recitation from Dr. Machen. And he was really a very genial fellow. But he saw things so clearly, and he saw what modernism was doing. They called it modernism then, they call it liberalism now. He saw what it was doing and how it was taking over the seminaries, and he felt it necessary to make a strong stand. Now, in those days, practically all the seminaries in the country of any age had been taken over. And most of these seminaries in the country today that stand for the Bible have been founded within the last 40 years. Most of those that were in existence then were taken over by the unbelievers. But at that time, most of them had been taken over. But Princeton had a tremendous reputation as a scholarly place. And people could point to it and say, they believe the Bible's true. They teach that Jesus really is God. They teach that Jesus was really raised from the dead. And the liberals didn't like that. And they were determined to get possession of Princeton. And Dr. Machen was the biggest stumbling block in the way of their doing. Many of the other faculty stood with him, but they did not have the same ability to present or the same personal standing that he did. And so the enemies of the faith did everything they could to hinder him. And they spread stories that his money, he was virtually independent financially from his parents. They spread the story that it had come from liquor, that his money had come from liquor. Well, he rarely tried to defend himself. But one day I was walking with him up in the Canadian Rockies, and I had occasion to refer to that. And, he says, I'd hate to think that a cent of my money had come from such a source. But this was a story that they spread about him. They just did everything they possibly could hurt him. Now, of course, this doesn't mean he was perfect. He made mistakes. And one of his mistakes was very unfortunate. I'll speak of that a little later. But I would like to take a little rest now for about 10 minutes, if you'd join me there. I find that I have remarkable strength and health for my age. I think we're 88. But if I overdo, I get muscle tired. And particularly at the beginning, doesn't matter so much after I have a little rest.
We have some special prayer requests from the seminary and Lisa Baumgartner, who she doesn't wasn't able to come tonight, so she got them. You know, some of the I guess she gets them from Rita.
And I should mention that the first day we went down a ways, and then there was a sort of a wide ledge which we followed along, and then we came to a little larger place in the canyon down there below, but it was as large as from here to that side of the room square maybe, and we put on our beds there, and I got to sleep nicely, and then she woke me up. She said, "Look, there's a rattlesnake. And right over there, just as near as you are, Johnny, a little nearer maybe, this one, there was a great big crooked stick." That kind of story was spoiled by her telling you she didn't see a snake. But now, I could take an hour of Dr. Mason, another hour, I mean, very easily, and want to speak of Dr. Schaefer too, so I'll have to be content with what I have to tell, what led up from one to the other. And that takes a bit of time. And that, I think, is important. And it's very interesting, I think, though rather sad. It would take an hour or two telling about how the liberals got control of Princeton Seminary. And Dr. Machen and other members of the faculty there decided it'd be necessary to start a new seminary. And they started the seminary, and we had as fine a group of students as I've ever seen in my life. Oh, they were wonderful Christian fellows. And it was, that first year there, it was just heaven. It was just wonderful. The spirit of the students, they had, they were giving up a lot of the prestige they would have had graduating from Princeton and giving up many opportunities in coming there. But they were earnest and faithful, and most of them had good minds, and it was a wonderful experience. But now, Dr. Machen made what I think was the great mistake of his life. We started in training the students. I began my teaching there the first year of Westminster Seminary. And during the time of our difficulties at Princeton, we were ready to reach out for help almost anywhere we could get it. And there was a denomination known as the Christian Reformed Church, a Dutch denomination that had its start in Holland and made up of, includes a great many very fine Christian people. But there are one or two things they've been noted for, and one is their emphasis, you might say, on all the points of doctrine of the Calvinistic system. A very evenly placed emphasis. And I personally feel that it is very important that we put our emphasis where Dr. Machen put it, on the great central fundamentals of the faith, on the great principles of salvation through Christ, the deity of Christ, the truth of the Bible, and so on. But there were three, in our faculty of eight, there were three who came from that background. And these three had this tendency, I thought, to greatly emphasize what I thought were, while true, secondary points. And when you overemphasize any secondary point, I feel there's a tendency not to put as much emphasis, should be, on the great central features. And through the years, this influence developed. And this was particularly true through the influence of a very able man and a very nice man. I liked him personally very much. This is Dr. Van Til. I liked him personally very much, but in his emphasis, I thought it was very detrimental. He stressed there's no such thing as a brute fact. Well, now, Princeton has always stood for the evidential method. That's what Dr. Machen stood for. And that was what they were emphasized. They emphasized through the years. Some people try to make the ridicule of today, saying that's the old Scottish common sense philosophy. Well, some of the Scotch thinkers may have developed it, but the fact is, where are you going to start? You have to start with yourself. You have to look at the evidence. And if you look fairly at the evidence points to God. Where did this world come from? It's clear that it didn't just grow out of itself. It didn't just come out of nowhere. Anything so wonderfully designed has to have a designer. And so the evidential evidence of the truth of Christianity, Princeton Seminary had emphasized all through its history. But Dr. Machen, while he taught his classes wonderfully, and his work in his special courses was very, very excellent, he had such a vision of the necessity to try to make a stand throughout the country for the faith, a stand against liberalism through the country, that he would come in, teach his classes, do an excellent job, and then go out and spend a great deal of his time and effort in trying to raise a banner against unbelief. And that's good, of course. But the result was that these three members of faculty, and in particular Dr. Van Til, exercised an influence that was quite different from what Dr. Machen's influence would have been. Now that was made all the more strong because of the fact that, as I said, Dr. Van Til was a very nice fellow, and I believe he was really a true Christian, and I liked him personally very much, but he had tremendous influence over the students. And in a very brief time, he had everybody there adopting his non-evidential view in his classes in apologetics. He says, there's no such thing as a brute fact. We don't start with yourself. You must start with God. Well, we can't start with God. We can't get to God to start. We have to start where we are. Start with the evidence. I used to say, how can you just start with the fact of God? Oh, no, he said, it's not just the idea of God. You start with the God of the Bible. You start with the triune God. Well, why don't you just have to start with Buddhism or Mohammedanism? You're going to start that way with assuming something. He said, we must presuppose the God of the Bible. Well, I always felt that apologetics was sort of as if the communists conquered America, and a little band of us went up into a high mountain in glaciers and dug a hole in the glacier and got in a place where we couldn't be reached, we'd be perfectly safe. I presuppose Christianity, and that's the end of it. But that's no way to reach anybody else. We could stay up there forever while the communists took over the whole country. We need the approach of the starting getting the evidences and looking at them. Only God can convert us, but we need to show of man the error of false thinking and the basis of our Christian faith. And Dr. Machen wrote wonderful things on the evidential basis of our Christian faith. Faith is not simply an emotion. It's ideas founded on fact, he believed, and I believe so too. And toward the end of his life, he said to me one day, he said, as between Van Til's apologetics and the old apologetic of Princeton, I stand with Warfield and the Princeton apologetic every single time. And I just lately got a paper in which a Dutch professor out in the Middle West has written an article on the philosophies of Princeton comparing the article, the philosophies of Princeton and of Westminster, and which he brings out very clearly that this was a complete break. And he tells of having talked with Van Til and having Van Til tell him that toward the end of the time there, Dr. Machen and he were on the train, and Dr. Van Til described his view to Dr. Machen, and Dr. Machen expressed his strong disagreement with it, and Dr. Van Til said, well, maybe I ought to drop out of the seminary. And Dr. Machen, who was a great gentleman, very fine, pleasant character, and despite his strong stand that he took, Dr. Machen said, oh, he says, no, I wouldn't want you to do that. Well, it wouldn't have made any difference if he had then, because his influence had been tremendous among the students. And from my experience with the students in the first two or three years there, of the wonderful character, they came from fine Christian background, and they really wanted to serve the Lord. And it was a grand experience my first few years of my life. My last 3 years there, I felt my life was just being wasted. The students were getting into this attitude of mind where you were ready to fight over every particular point of doctrine. Even the most small difference between denominations. And as I used to say, when you major on the minors, you're pretty sure to minor on the majors. And I sometimes saw somebody who could detect a trace of Arminianism a block away. And he could walk right up to a liberal and not realize there was anything wrong with him. And I think that is the harm that was done. Well, now, Dr. Machen's error was in not being more careful as to what was being taught in the seminary and realizing that not having fine Christian men teaching isn't enough. You have to be sure that the view they're presenting, particularly those who, like Van Til, are very able at getting their ideas into people's minds, is in line with what you would like to have presented. But Dr. Machen was making a stand throughout the country against liberalism and writing articles and presenting evidences of the faith. And in the seminary, he taught his courses, he presided at faculty meetings, and otherwise he was occupied with these external occupations. But the education that was being given was such, and the students were such a fine caliber, that if we could have been patient for a few years, I feel sure we would have had our graduates in the leading Presbyterian pulpits in the United States. And then, if the liberals got such control of the denomination that it was necessary for us to step out, why, we would have taken out a large group. But as it was, after Dr. Machen started a foreign mission board, and people were confused by his great ability into thinking that his mission board was more widely known than it was, and they got frightened, the leadership of the denomination, and so they took action against the board and anybody who was connected with it, and immediately all the fine ministers that he had gotten into it that were pastors of big churches resigned from the board, and then he got recent graduates in their place, and then the denomination said that a man should be expelled from the ministry if he didn't support the boards of the church. And of course, that is utterly heretical to take a stand like that. But then Dr. Machen and his associates said the denomination has made itself legally apostate by that action, and so it's time for all the Christians to get out now. Well, that had been done after a few decades of getting graduates into the good churches, which we certainly would have done, because the people, even if they didn't know much about doctrine, could see the difference between the students we were graduating, who really believed something, and the graduates the liberal seminaries were putting in. But that shut us off into a small group. And the result of it was that when Dr. Machen, 3 years before the end of the time I was there, organized a Presbyterian Constitutional Covenant Union to get Christians in the denomination, in this large denomination, to take a stand against the power of liberalism in the denomination. And they got people into it who weren't much informed doctrinally. Among the students, Dr. Machen became very unpopular. And in the next to the last year we were there, he was very unpopular among the students. They felt that he was a traitor because he was working with people that weren't absolutely straight on the doctrine being taught. And all their doctrine was being put on a level. And this was the answer on every point, instead of seeing, like Dr. Machen would, the importance of the great central fundamentals, and then the comparatively less importance and yet real importance of certain of our important doctrines. Which, and when these students got in, they immediately began, some of them began saying, well, to take liquor, to take wine in communion, grape juice isn't wine, we have to have fermented liquor. And of course, that didn't appeal to most of our Christian people. And they were taking stands on, some said, well, it isn't right to sing anything except song. This Dutch denomination that three of the men had come from originally said, only sing songs. Well, the songs are beautiful. But that's not a thing to make a central point. And the result was that when they started their new denomination, which they called the Presbyterian Church of America, it was a small group that came out and joined the group. And Dr. Machen then went from place to place where there were little groups trying to help them, and he just threw himself into this, and it took them away from his great work. And he was so devoted then to trying to develop this new church that when he went up to North Dakota, where they had three little churches in December, three little churches with a few people in each and 50 miles between them, and the graduate who was there arranged for him to speak in all three churches several times in the course of 2 or 3 days, and the weather was 50 below zero, and they were going from one church to the other. Dr. Machen got pneumonia and died. And once he was gone, then without his restraining hand, these attitudes became quite obvious. They had before already, the students, of course, had criticized Dr. Machen. So before Dr. Machen said to me, he says, that's fine for them to stand for the Reformed faith. He says, let them stand up in the Constitutional Covenant Union and let them speak out for the Reformed faith. That's great. But he says, we're making a fight for the very central issues of the gospel, and they shouldn't get all excited about things that important as they are secondary to it. But Dr. Machen was utterly unpopular among the students in that next to the last year. But then in the last year, when he was thrown out for his support of the independent board, thrown out of the church, and they started the new church, of course, he then became a hero again and was quite popular with the students after that. And I don't think he ever realized what had happened. While he was doing this great work in the external field, the seminary that he was building that should have been the training institution to send out people to stand for the truth and exercise a wide influence for the great things of the gospel was being taken over by something that he personally did not believe in. Well, the thing got to the point. Dr. Machen died on January 1st, 1937. And he was a martyr to his determination to carry through these appointments he made. And in spite of weather, in spite of feeling miserable, he was a real hero. He was determined to do it, but it was impossible to do it under the circumstances, and when he got the pneumonia, he died. And of course, we were all utterly frustrated by the loss of Dr. Mitchell. Was a tremendous loss. And when you think of, he was only 50 years of age. And when you think of what he did in those years, of the books he wrote, of the studying he did, of the personal influence he had, he was one of the great figures of the century. Dr. Eppert told me of seeing a review by one of the liberals of Dr. Machen's life right after his death. And he said, this man said, when he writes an article on some minor point, perhaps, you find that he has read everything that's written on the subject, even the most obscure monograph. He said, it seems almost superhuman the way he's able to cover material in all these fields. He was a marvelous figure, but he made one sad mistake, unfortunately. And that one mistake resulted in the institution that he founded to be a great institution for the Word of God becoming an institution to stand for an alien philosophy, contrary to what had been taught at Princeton all those years, and with an attitude of putting such tremendous emphasis on secondary points that the primary points might easily get lost in the shuffle. Well, the thing reached the point where I had to resign. There was nothing else I could do. And so I issued my resignation. And then three students came to me. Now, we had at that time about 70 students. And these three I knew, but I did not know particularly well. And they came to me, and they said to me, they said, we are married, and we live outside. And they said, most of the students are single. And they said, the professors give the material so fast, it's all you can do to write it down and memorize it. You don't have time to think about it. But they said, we go home with our notes, and our wife copies it on the typewriter. And she says, why, you don't believe that, do you? Do you believe that? And he says, we stop and think. Oh, I don't believe that. I don't. And so they were thinking for themselves. And the others were taking what was given them. They said, they give it to us so fast, all we can do is just memorize it. And of course, they had the idea that we were the eighth greatest scholars in the world. I was one of the eight, of course. So it was a shock to them when I resigned. Big shock. But these three men came, and they said, and these three who were married, very few married, and they said, we feel exactly as you've expressed yourself in your resignation. And I said, well, we cannot let this testimony go to nothing. We've got to start a new institution. And they said, well, we will stand with you. We'll stand with you. And a month before the beginning of the fall, I had a dream. Fall came, and we started school, and we had three students. That was rather of a nightmare. But when we started, we had a very good entry. It was largely due to Dr. Buswell, who had seen what was happening. He had sent most of a great many of the students who had come during those years. He had sent, and he saw what was happening. He saw the situation, and he sent us a fine entering class. And we had a very good class. We started a new institution. Well, now, these three fellows who came to us were two brothers from Canada, and a young fellow named Francis Schaefer, whom I had in my classes. He always did top rate, but I didn't really know him otherwise. I had practically no contact with him until the end of my last year there and his second year. And he came to me, and he was so interested in what we were going to do because he'd seen these same things that I brought out in my letter of resignation. He had seen them and been disturbed by them. and was at one with me on it. And so during that summer, we looked around, we found a place where there was a church that would let us use their Sunday school rooms for our meetings. And he went, that was 25 miles away from where we lived at that time. He went there, he found houses that were available for our, to room our students, because in those days all the students lived with you there. And people said rarely on 14th Street had there been a house for sale. There were four for sale that year, right on that street, just a block from the seminary. Well, we bought them, and he went around the secondhand places getting plumbing materials and different things, and he and I worked together all summer. And so he had his first child born during that summer. But he worked on that. And he was tremendous help to me. And we got the institution started, and then he was tremendous help for me in developing things. And of course, that was one of the most wonderful years I ever had in my life, because I had, at Princeton, I'd known the faculty very well, and I had heard of their inner discussions and everything, and I had seen things I didn't like there, things I did like, and so on. And then during the 8 years of teaching after that, we had discussed everything in faculty meetings, and I knew what I liked and what I didn't like, and we could start from scratch. At Westminster, everything had to be just like it was at Princeton. Oh, you had to do everything just like the old Princeton. It was just fine to say the old Princeton. Well, we left all our precedents behind us. We started from scratch. And not from nothing, but from knowledge and observation, what was good and what wasn't so good. And we started in and we developed on different lines than minor things, but for the same gospel that Dr. Machen had stood for, with the same views he stood for. And Francis Schaeffer had one more year there. Well, Francis graduated. After he and Jack Murray, by the way, became very good friends there. Jack was the first year student that year. But Francis graduated, and he took a little church out in western Pennsylvania. And in this church, they had 18 people when he took it. And he worked his head off in the church. And he looked around, and how am I going to reach these people? Well, he said, there's not much for children here. So he organized things for the children. He had summer camps and different organizations, and he just worked his head off. And he told me he would plan his sermons on Monday. And then every day he'd go in the church and he would give both sermons each day. And Sunday morning he'd go down there early and he'd give both sermons there. And then he'd give the morning sermon. He said in the afternoon he'd come back and he'd preach his evening sermon. So he tell you there wasn't a lazy bone in his body. He just worked there and he built it up in a year and a half to from 18 to 120. He told me, I'm never going to tackle a job like this one again. He said, this was just too much. He got little sleep, worked awfully hard. But he was just heart and soul for the faith, for the work, and he had such a sympathy for people, such an interest in human beings, tremendous, and such an ability to explain things and to help them in every possible way. And when he'd been at the church 6 months, they built a new building. I went out and gave the inaugural sermon when it opened, and then after he'd been there 7 years, he was called to a church in St. Louis. It was quite a little larger after his year and a half, and he was there for a few years, and he built it up. And then one day I was in a meeting of a missionary board, and they said, the war's just over, First World War. No, this was Second World War. It was just over, and they said, here's a letter from a man who's pastor of one of our little churches, and he says there's tremendous need over in Europe for missionaries now after the war, and I think you ought to send me over there representing you. And someone said to me, what do you think about that? Well, I said, I don't think he would do anything worth doing. I don't think we should send him. Now, I said, well, somebody like Francis Schaeffer, that would be worthwhile. And they decided to send him over to look around for some. And he went over. I met him over there. I went over to buy books from the seminary library that year. I met him over there, and he went all over Europe, finding real earnest Christians and making contacts with them. And he settled down in Switzerland. And after he was there for a few years, oh, you must read his wife's book, The Labrie Story. But she tells how he converted to Christ, one of the Roman Catholics in this canton, which is a Roman Catholic canton. And that upset them so that they ordered him to leave Switzerland. And he had only so much longer to stay. And the Lord intervened. He moved to a Protestant canton, found a place there. It's miraculous, the story of how he started his Labrie work there. But his old work was gone. His connections there were gone. And so he went into the University of Lausanne there, which was a few miles from where they found a house in a Protestant canton and got permission to stay in Switzerland. He went in there, and he would sit in the cafeteria and talk with students. And he got to know the mind of the student of that day as nobody else in the world did. And then when students began coming to Labrie, he knew just how to meet their questions, just how to show them. He knew what they would think about most everything, because liberalism was teaching the same things in colleges all over the country, all over the world. And out of those defeats, combined with his tremendous work, I envied his energy. He developed a wonderful work there at Labrie. Many, many people he led to the Lord, especially young students. He did a tremendous work there. I wish I had an hour to talk about Francis. But you see how Francis and Machen, their lives were connected, you see, as I've described. And it was my privilege to be a friend with both of them and to help both of them in any way that I possibly could. But I was one of the joys of my life, the knowledge of these two wonderful people. Well, I think we better stop there now. If you'll excuse me, I'll go home. I think in many ways I'm as able as I ever was, but I get tired. And if I overdo, I'm laid up. So I have to have frequent rests. If I have frequent rests, I get a lot of work done. But if I get interested and don't get the rest, I may be laid up a day or two. So I'll say
that. Thank you for your questions.